This and other podcasts are available on the Gun Rights Radio Network, gunrightsradio.com. Podcasting freedom.
Hi, folks. This is Bob Main. The reason I carry a gun is because I can't carry a cop. Welcome to the 19th episode of the Midweek Podcast, commonly called the MSP Middle of the Week Podcast. MSP is for Modern Self-Protection. Most of the time, Ben Branham does these Middle of the Week shows. I'm going to do it this week. Both of us have been incredibly busy with our real jobs, but I happen to have the time to do this middle of the week show, so I'm going to fill in. But check out his podcast called the Modern Self-Protection Podcast. Just go to modernselfprotection.com. Well, this is dedicated to answering voicemails. Been getting a lot of voicemails. Matter of fact, so many voicemails that I pretty much have to make an entire show out of it, which is a good thing. I like that. Doing this a little bit differently. I'm not in the Handgun World mobile studio. I'm actually sitting in the comfy confines of a nice hotel room here and staring at my computer and talking to you guys. I don't have my regular headset, so if this sounds a little different, then you'll know why. I'm just kind of speaking to the recorder. So going to talk about some voicemails here on the Handgun World podcast. All kinds of subjects. I mean, it just kind of runs the gamut. So that's why the title of this is just Listener Voicemails. So let's jump right into the first one. Chad in Dallas. Here you go.
Hey, Bob. Chad up here in Dallas. Just give me a quick call listening to your midweek podcast in regards to 22 long rifle conversions. And you'd mentioned about the M&P, and that's what I train with. I carry a M&P compact. I have an M&P full size as well for kind of range purposes and just more plinking and fun shooting. But I also have the M&P 22, which is basically a mirror image of the full size, even with the medium grip. You can't interchange the back straps, but they kind of designed it with the medium grip and purpose. Some safeties on all, so the manual of arms on the firearms are all the same across the compact, the full size, and the M&P 22. So it's been a great training tool for me. Obviously, it allows me to get a lot more trigger time than normal, especially with the ammo prices that they are nowadays. But wanted to let you know that the M&P 22, mine especially, loves the CCI Blazer that you had mentioned. It also loves CCI Minimag. And it'll actually, once broken in, we'll shoot, CCI standard velocity, and most of kind of the bulk box stuff as well. You know, it's more accurate with some than others. The high velocity stuff tends to be a little bit more accurate out of the pistol. But it's a great training tool. It allows me to work on everything. I change the sights out to match exactly what my full size sights look like. So that's, you know, basically just smaller bullet coming out of the same size pistol, so allows me to get a lot more trigger time. Bob, appreciate all that you've done. Keep up the good work. Wanted to let you know, I also did the same thing with my AR-15. I built up the CMMG 22 dedicated upper, then put it on the, you know, I put on my AR-15 lower as well, but the upper is ergos and everything are exactly like my AR-15, so I can do the same, you know, high round training with a 22 long rifle AR-15. As well. So then getting a lot more trigger time with that as well. So that tends to be the way we're going to be going here for a little while. I think the 22 long rifle might be the best way to go if government agencies keep buying up all the ammunition and all the orders and everyone else that's doing it. We obviously know that nobody's shooting all that ammo right now. So I wish people would just stop throwing it in their closet and actually take it out to the range. But I just would like to take advantage of any ammunition that's in stock at the moment. So, again, keep up the good work, and we'll see you in March at the training class here in Dallas. Talk soon. Hey, Bob, Chad in Dallas again. Sorry, I totally forgot to mention on the last message there another training tool that I've been taking advantage of, and of all things, it's Airsoft. With some of the higher-end models that are out there, with gas blowback systems, and stuff of that sort, you get the true feel, of shooting. You get the tactical response, obviously, with the slide coming back after each shot. You can obviously track your targets instead of dry firing. It's safe to do in the garage, safe to do inside a room that, you know, you might not have, you know, any vases or crystals sitting around, because those BBs will come out 300, 400, you know, feet per square, or what is it, square feet, square inch, whatever it is. But no, that's another tool to use, a gas blowback pistol, airsoft pistol would be a great training tool to get a lot more training time. I do it in the garage. Have a little BB collection system where it goes through the cardboard IDPA targets and just drops into a bucket, and I can just recycle all the little rubber BBs. So that's another option. Get a lot more trigger time now that ammunition is so expensive. All right. That might be a good topic for a full show, airsoft training. I don't know if you do it right now or if you can somebody that you could talk to in regards to doing it, but it tends to be a good way to get a lot of good trigger time. All right. Talk to you.
Thanks for the idea, Chad. I think I will do a complete show on that. Okay, let's take the first voicemail. Training with 22s. As most of you know, not too long ago, I did a middle-of-the-week show, and I talked about training with 22 long rifle. And I talked about the Advantage Arms 22 long rifle conversion kit for my Glock 19. Actually, haven't had a chance to get out and shoot that yet, but I'm going to be doing that pretty soon. I also bought a CMMG 22 long rifle conversion bolt carrier group for my AR-15, essentially turning my AR-15 into a 22, turning my Glock into a 22. Now, there's pros and cons to this. First of all, I'm sure you've probably all noticed, it's really hard to find 22 long rifle ammunition. It's hard to find. I'll tell you this. I've been finding a lot of it on gunbroker.com. Yeah, you have to pay a premium. Folks, I think we have to get out of our minds what ammo used to cost. That's the best suggestion I can give right now. Get it out of your mind. I know it used to be cheap. It's not cheap anymore. 22 now costs about the same as what 9mm used to cost about like 4 or 5 months ago. It's about the same price as what 9mm used to be. Isn't that a shame? That's awful. I was at a gun store in San Antonio the other day, and 9mm American Eagle 9mm FMJ, $22.50 a box. Give me a break. $22.50 a box. And now some of you might say, well, gee, that's cheap. You know, I've heard rumors of 9mm FMJ going for $30 a box. Is that right? I mean, this is insanity. So practicing with 22s. So one of the disadvantages is that it's tough to find. But if you're the kind of person that has stored a lot of 22, like, for example, I have a friend of mine here that's got 13 bricks. So what is that? 13 times 550 rounds in a brick. That's a lot of 22 ammo. If you're the kind of person that's been hoarding 22 ammo, it might be a really good thing for you to conserve some of your regular calibers and train with 22 whenever you can. So Chad, that M&P 22 looks like it's a pretty cool pistol. I've seen them for sale at various gun stores, and I've heard a lot of great things about them. As far as your second voicemail about training with airsoft, yeah, that's a good idea too. These kinds of things give you trigger time, and I think they're better than dry firing. I think that using a 22, I don't know about airsoft, but I think that using a 22 is a little bit better than dry firing. You do get a little bit of recoil with a 22, but most importantly, you're shooting real ammunition, so you get to see where your bullets are. You get to practice bullet placement, and of course, isn't that really what it's all about? Trigger control and bullet placement. That's the most effective way to be good with your handgun. Isn't that what makes the big difference? Is bullet placement. Not so much caliber, but where are you shooting? So you get a chance to work on your marksmanship and also trying to figure out where you're hitting when you're practicing your defensive technique. So good stuff, Chad. Thanks for calling again. I'm looking forward to seeing you at the Beyond Concealed Carry course coming up shortly here in about a week and a half from the date that this podcast is posted. And that's a sold-out class, by the way. Okay, my good friend Damien from Dallas, who has called in quite a bit, and that's okay. I like it when Damien calls in because he has some pretty thoughtful things to say. Looks like I've got three different short voicemails from Damien, which is okay. See, one of the problems with my voicemail is that it cuts you off after 3 minutes. But I know sometimes you guys have another thought or another topic and you want to call in, and that's fine. By the way, the number is 210-646-1727. 210-646-1727. I'd like to have you call the show. So let's listen to Damien's three short voicemails, and then I will take them one by one and make a comment.
Hey, Bob, this is Damien from Dallas. Just wanted to send you a quick voice message. I'm listening to episode 217 with you and Ben talking about military versus civilian training. And, man, I just have to really just back up what Ben said. I'm a former U.S. Army soldier. I was an M1 A1 tank gunner during the first Gulf War, that Desert Storm. But my carry weapon in the U.S. Army was the Beretta M9, or what some people know it as, the 92FS, which is the civilian version. And all the years I spent in the military, 4 years active duty, 1 year in reserves, actually Army National Guard, as an M1 tank crewman, when I got out of the military, I actually attended, and this is a few years after I got out, I attended my first firearms handgun training course, or training class, I should say, and I have a Beretta 92FS. You know, once you, like Ben said, once you get used to something, you kind of just stick with it, and I still think that's a fantastic firearm. But I went to that class with that gun, and I know that gun in and out. I can field strip it, blindfold it, put it back together, everything. And I learned more in that one day of civilian training than I did in all the 4 years I was in full-time active duty in the military about how to shoot and operate that weapon. Just the techniques and different individual things that I just never learned. So it's absolutely true. Although the military has some great training, and I think obviously Ben can probably speak to this better than I can, but it seems like the training is improving. They're focusing a lot more on individual firearms training, which is great. But the civilian training, there's a lot to say about the civilian training. And it just so happens that the trainers were former military guys, but in the civilian sector, you go over things sometimes that you just don't find in the military. So it is a great mixture. You know, if you're in the military or a police officer, definitely civilian training is an absolute must. So I absolutely agree with Ben. And then, Bob, you said something that I've never thought about. When you mentioned that, you know, all these anti-gun people talk about how military-style weapons are, you know, should be in the hands of police officers and military soldiers, and you know, piggybacking off of what Ben said, I've never thought about that. You're absolutely right. That is a misconception or misunderstanding, because many of the civilian operators that operate these AR-15s and M4s, in many cases, are a lot more trained or you know, a lot more prepared to use that weapon than some people in the military. So, sorry, I cut off there, Bob, but like I was just going to finish real quick my thought there, that you made such a great point. I don't know why I've never actually thought about that, because I'm hearing this stuff in the news all the time that, you know, these weapons are designed for police and military use. There's no reason for a civilian to have it, when, in fact, you're right. In many cases, not all cases, in many cases, the civilians know how to use the civilian counterparts of those weapons a lot more effectively, because they, for one thing, they probably do more training. You know, or like Ben said, sometimes these are just tools that someone looks like, you know, like you said, like a fountain pen in your shirt, where in the civilian sector, you know, the people that get into civilian training or individual training sometimes take it a little more serious, and it's weird to think that, but it's true, because it's not your daily job, so you tend to focus on what you're learning a little more in some cases. That's, you know, that's always an exception to the rule. But, hey, great podcast and great point. I'm going to add that to my arsenal of aha, you know, type of statements, and start using that as a way to educate people on another angle of this entire gun debate. So appreciate that, and you learn something new every day, and I'm always learning from you, Bob, so appreciate your podcast. Hey, Bob, this is Damien from Dallas. Just wanted to ask you a question on podcast 217. I keep hearing you talk about how Google is not friendly to shooters. And I would just like for you to expand on that. Explain to me why you believe that, why you feel that way. My expertise is technology. So this is something I'm very, very familiar with. And as far as tracking your searches, you can turn that off. The reason Google tracks your searches is to better serve the advertisements to the things that you have searched in the past, the things that you have cared about. So what it is an algorithm that tries to learn the things that you like, and the only way they can put advertisements relative to what you have liked in the past is to track those searches, but you can go and turn that off. And as far as searching for classes or trainers or anything like that, the Google search engine is just an algorithm, and I have no issues with finding anything, any information. Now, if people are talking about going to the Google shopping portion of their site and then searching for a gun, then they need to learn how to use Google. The Google algorithm is optimized for the standard search. The shopping thing is just a gimmick. So anyway, so if you can just expand on why you feel that way, maybe I can help, and maybe there's something that you just don't know that you can turn on or off, or maybe if there's something that you have found that I'm not aware of, I'd like to know about it, because I don't have any issues with Google and finding firearm information, training, ammo, you name it. So just wanted to ask that question. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Damien. Hey, have I ever thanked you for your service to our country? I don't believe I have, so let me take this opportunity to do that. Thanks for the compliment earlier in the first part of your voicemails there. You know, what he's talking about is a comment that I made when I was talking with Ben about the differences between military and civilian training. The anti-gunners, see, one thing we have to do right now during this education period, and I call it an education period because we have to educate the uninformed. One thing that I was making a point of is that so many of the anti-gunners, they point to us civilians and say, nah, 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 you don't have any training. You shouldn't be having these weapons because you're not well trained. What they don't understand is that there are a lot of military and law enforcement personnel that don't have really any more training than most civilians. Now, this is not to knock military and law enforcement. Again, I'm not putting them down. But I've taught a pretty fair amount of training classes already. And I have military and law enforcement people coming through my classes. And one of my co-instructors, Ben Branham, well, my only co-instructor for the classes that we do independently, is a military combat veteran. So there you go, folks. And Ben freely admits that he's learned a tremendous amount in the civilian world that he did not learn in the military, and vice versa. So, Damien, thanks for reinforcing that point. I appreciate that. About Google, the last voicemail that you called in. About Google, first of all, I just feel uncomfortable about my searches being tracked. I don't care what the reason is. Even if they're looking for algorithms to send me advertisement and stuff like that. I don't know, something I just don't like too much. But the biggest reason I'm not much of a Google fan anymore is because last May, in May of 2012, they basically let their anti-gun sentiments be known. And basically they told people that on the Google shopping network that they cannot sell weapons or weapons-related material through Google. In fact, here's the quote from Google, quote, "We do not allow the promotion or sale of weapons and any related products such as ammunitions or accessory kits on Google Shopping," end quote. Then they also went on to say later, quote, "In order to comply with our new policies, please remove any weapon-related products from your data feed and then resubmit your feed in the merchant center," unquote. So anyway, Damien, that's the biggest reason why I'm not a big fan of Google. Maybe I kind of misspoke, didn't make that real clear in that previous podcast. As always, Damien, good to hear from you. Thanks for calling in. And let's go to Dave in Utah.
Hey, Bob. This is Dave in Utah calling. I was just listening to your interview with Alan Houck, I believe. You're talking about concealed carry on campus, among other things. One of the arguments that I hear against allowing teachers to have concealed carry permits is that, you know, teachers are not trained. They wouldn't be able to figure out what was going on. They wouldn't be able to do anything to stop it. But one thing you can bring up is that we know the principal of Sandy Hook Elementary School, a lady named Dawn Hochsprung, when the madman came into her school and started shooting, you know, she recognized what was going on. She knew that this guy was in there. He was there to kill her kids. And she knew that she had to take action. And she did. And she did pretty much the only thing she could do. She charged him as fast as she could to try and stop him because she knew that's what had to happen. Unfortunately for her, she didn't have any weapons or anything to fight back with. But to say that the teachers would not be able to do that is wrong, and it's an insult to our teachers, I think. So it's just something to think about. Even, you know, Dawn Hochsprung, with whatever level of training she had, she figured out what was going on, and she knew that she had to try and stop the guy. Anyway, thanks for keeping up the show, and keep it up. Bye.
Good point, Dave. Thanks for the call-in. As a matter of fact, I want to share something with you that kind of reinforces Dave's point that he just made. The front page of the USA Today, I'm looking at it right now, for February 19th, 2013. That's the day that I'm recording this. Right on the front page, there's an article about police are now telling schools, as a last resort, take out the shooter. Now, what I thought that was interesting here, I'm going to point out in this article. Let me use the name of Patrick Baraducci. I think I pronounced that right. I hope I did. He's the police chief of Medina, Ohio. He's quoted in this article. And here's his quote. "For a long time, we've been teaching people to be victims. But sometimes the only choice you're going to have is to die or fight back. I've been in this business for 39 years, he said. I never thought it would get to this point." Okay, once again, that was Patrick Baraducci, police chief of Medina, Ohio. And I'm getting this from the USA Today. Now, what I find striking about this is that, well, first of all, he's right. For a long time, we've been teaching people to be victims, especially in schools. He's right about that. Then he says, "I've been in this business for 39 years, meaning the law enforcement business, and I never thought it would get to this point." That's what shocks me. Really? For 39 years? I mean, he's been doing this 39 years. He never thought it would get to this point. That's the problem we have in America. And again, I'm not putting this police chief down. He's probably a pretty good cop and a pretty good police chief. But here's the problem. People have their head in the sand, folks. They're like ostriches. They're sticking their heads in the sand and they're denying what's going on today. They never thought it would get to this point. People just don't want to admit the type of world we live in. Would you agree with me on that? They just can't get it. They can't get the fact that their kids might be in danger in school because some madman might come in with guns and start shooting the school up. Get over it, people. You know, don't take 39 years like this police chief to finally realize, oh, wow, we're at the point where we got to start doing something. Okay, so let's get our head out of the sand and start realizing this is serious business. We got to start protecting ourselves. We got to start protecting our kids. We got to start protecting movie theater goers. We got to start taking responsibility for ourselves. Get your heads out of the sand and realize that's the world that we live in today. And I firmly believe this is never going to stop until good people, good citizens, start fighting back. Sometimes you have to fight fire with fire. And I think that we're at that situation today. Maybe not all the time, but oftentimes you have to do that. In this same USA Today article, the United States Capitol Police are fighting back. They're describing that as a last resort, fighting back. But here's what's interesting. This comes from the U.S. Capitol Police. Let me quote them. Quote, "You must be committed to the actions you're going to take, and your attack must be explosive and violent. You must do whatever it takes to survive. You want to disable the attacker with whatever means you can." Now, unquote. That's the good part. Here's the bad part. This could involve throwing items or using objects to strike, stab, or slash. Well, okay, throwing items at the bad guy or using objects to strike or stab or slash him. Okay, that's a good thing. How about a gun, folks? Huh? How about using a gun to shoot back? Why won't they advocate that? Frustrating, isn't it? Anyway, Dave, thanks for the voicemail. Okay, next, let's go to L in Las Vegas.
Hey, Bob, this is L from Las Vegas, and I just wanted to leave you a quick message, practically explaining a little bit of what I've learned given the current situation in regards to ammo availability, prices, availability of certain firearms. So I have been for a while, about a year or two, strictly a 5.56 and 9mm guy. So I have a couple ARs and a couple handguns, again, Glocks, 9mm, and my AR is chambered in 5.56. And I figured it's the most abundant ammunition available. I'll be good to go no matter what. However, nowadays, you can barely find 9mm, and 5.56 is priced out of my reach to some degree, at least in the quantities that I want to purchase it in, if I can even find it. So what I started to do is I started to think it was probably a mistake to diversify, or to not diversify, rather, to pigeonhole myself into just two types of ammunition. My thought process was, well, it will be easier to stockpile the ammunition. However, in an event like this, it turns out that, may not be the case. So what I've done is I purchased the Glock 31, which is chambered in 357 SIG, and I've purchased the 40 cal conversion barrel. So now I have a 40 caliber firearm that I can use 40 cal if I need to, 357 SIG if I need to, and I still have my 9mm. I'm also looking at eventually getting a new Glock 30S, which is their smaller Glock 30 subcompact, so that I can have 40, 45, 357 SIG and 9mm at my disposal if that's the only ammunition I can find. So that's just one of the lessons that I've learned in regards to ammunition availability, being priced out of the market. So I wanted to know if you or any of your listeners have learned similar lessons or different lessons that I can learn from. I appreciate everything you do. I look forward to hearing the podcast coming up. Have a good one. Stay safe. Bye.
Thanks, L, for the voicemail. Very good point. You know, for a long time I've been advocating that it's important to get to diversify your calibers. Now, I made the same mistake, L. I standardized on 9mm and 45 for my pistols and 5.56 for my rifle. And, I mean, at least those are my predominant calibers. I have others, but those are predominant. Well, I guess that's kind of proved to be a mistake, kind of like what you found out, because those are hard to get right now. But here's the negative of what you're talking about. If you have pistols chambered in a bunch of different calibers, you got to store and stock and sort out and keep track of all those calibers as well. So you do get the advantage of having a gun that will shoot whatever is available out there. But then you have the disadvantages of having to store and keep track of a whole bunch of calibers. For me, because I didn't do what I wanted to do, because I didn't go out and buy that pistol in 357 SIG and get a 40 caliber conversion barrel, because I did not do that, instead of spending the money to go out and get another gun right now, I'm just hunting for ammo. And I am finding ammo out there. Even though I have to pay a premium, I'm finding it. Gunbroker.com. I've been getting a lot of 22 and 9mm off of Gunbroker lately. 45, I've been able to pick up occasionally a couple boxes here and there at the local Academy Sports and Outdoors stores around where I live in San Antonio. So it's kind of six of one, half a dozen of the other. If you can afford to go out and buy that extra gun, but then here's what I'm thinking. Well, okay, if I buy the extra gun in 357 SIG caliber, now I have to start buying that ammo also. This way I can just take the money that I would have spent on the gun and go out on the hunt for 9mm, 5.56, and 45. It's a personal choice. Right now I have all the firearms I need. Not all that I want, but I got all that I need. And, you know, I have enough to take care of business if I really need to. I'm not too worried about having guns. What I'm worried about is having more ammunition and more magazines. So that's what I've been on the hunt for the last couple of months, is lots of magazines and lots of ammunition for the guns that I already have. But, Elle, your strategy is a very good one. So you can pick up whatever ammo happens to be available, and hopefully you got a gun at home that can shoot it. Hopefully that's given you some things to think about. Elle, thanks for the voicemail, and I appreciate you calling in. By the way, folks, the number is 210-646-1727. Okay, before taking the next voicemail from Gary in Austin, a couple of them, I want to make the announcement that the San Antonio and the Dallas courses that Ben and I are teaching in March are both sold out. Hey, that's great for us, right? I mean, it's just been a huge response to taking training. Thank you very much, folks. We're doing a two-day event in April. So if you can't make it to the March class, there's a two-day event, April 13th and 14th, and then I've got my close-range gunfighting course with Suarez International coming up in May. So there are a few more opportunities for you to train with us or to train with me. The two-day event, April 13th and 14th, the first day is a beginner's class from 1 to 5. It's a four-hour beginner's course for $75. If you've got somebody you know in your family that is just getting started, or if you're listening and you've never had any formal training, this is going to be Handgun 101. We're going to start from square one. Even if someone's never picked up a gun before, that's okay. 4 hours, we're going to bring them up to speed from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. Saturday, April 13th in San Antonio. The next day, Sunday the 14th, is when we're going to teach Beyond Concealed Carry. That's a full day from 9 to 4. So that two-day event, you can come the first day through the beginner's class. This might be really good for a husband and wife couple. Maybe if one of them doesn't have a whole lot of experience shooting, come to the beginner's class on Saturday, then take Beyond Concealed Carry, which is the next step, on Sunday. You can come to both days for $199. If you want to come to just the beginner's class, it's $75. And if you want to come to Beyond Concealed Carry only, it's $150. So you do save some money if you come to both days. So something to think about. I just thought I would throw that out there. But the March classes are sold out. Enrollments have started for close-range gunfighting that I'm teaching in San Antonio. If you go to handgunworld.com, you will see registration links for everything I'm talking about. Handgunworld.com, register for all the classes that I'm talking about right now. Okay, let's take a voicemail from, two voicemails from Gary in Austin, Texas.
Hey, Bob, how's it going? My name's Gary. I live in Austin, Texas, just down the road from you. I'm also a college student as well. I just wanted to thank you for your podcast. I just started listening to it this week because I've been on the hunt for more information as the debate rages on, but I found your podcast and I started listening to it. I especially took interest in your podcast interview with Alan from San Antonio, I believe. I, as a college student who is actually about to get a CHL this weekend, at least a certification done, I've always wondered, you know, exactly what the rules are on campus carry. Obviously, you can't do it, but the debate about getting that actually passed is something that greatly interests me because, you know, what is the good of concealed carry if you can't carry it everywhere that you go? But, yeah, I just really wanted to thank you for the great work and the podcast. I'm going to be sifting through the episodes as I can and getting a little bit more information from you. But thanks again, and keep up the good work. Hey, Bob, how's it going? Gary here again from Austin, Texas. I just left you a voicemail recently, but I was listening to another podcast of yours, and it just kind of struck a chord with me. You were talking about the education of gun control advocates and how they come from an uninformed, perhaps even ignorant perspective most of the time. Well, my roommate here in Austin is actually from Michigan originally, and we have had many knockdown, drag-out fights about the gun control issue ever since the Newtown incident. And yesterday, actually, was one of the biggest breakthroughs I've had with him because he is emotionally against guns, irrationally so, especially handguns. And we finally kind of got to the core of the issue and really discovered that it was emotional and informational problem rather than a factual problem on his part. So we kind of argued back and forth for a few hours. There was actually a couple other people involved in the conversation as well. But we finally came around to the fact that we don't live in an ideal world, and he does believe that personal defense weapons are a necessary evil, in his opinion. I don't think that, but I'm just glad that I could get him to admit it. And, I'm going to keep sifting through these podcasts and keep up the good work. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Gary. Thanks for calling that in. Hey, I'm glad that your friend is now starting to warm up to the idea that maybe he needs to start taking responsibility and protecting himself. Interesting. Thanks for sharing that. You know, it kind of goes to my point that I was talking about earlier. We got people with their heads stuck in the sand. Sounds like your buddy might have been one of those people. But maybe he's now starting to wake up. It's an education process. I really believe, folks, that we are going to win this gun rights battle based on educating people. That's the secret. Educate people. Make sure that you have facts. The facts are going to be on your side. Make sure you have facts and make sure you can ask questions, ask pointed questions. For example, hey, I love it when I think it's Tom Gresham likes to say this. No, it wasn't Tom Gresham. I can't remember who, but he likes to ask people, what are you going to do if somebody breaks into your home? If you don't have a gun, what are you going to do if somebody busts in and they're armed and you don't have a gun? What are you going to do? And I think with all the events that have been happening lately, it's, you know, people are starting to realize that that's not out of the realm of possibility. Sorry, it was kind of a knockdown, drag out, whatever, but hopefully, hey, you know what, Gary? Take him shooting. Take him shooting if you can. Get him out to the range. You know, give him a safety lesson. Make sure that he's safe and everything. Take him shooting. Let him realize how fun it is. And let him get to realize that guns are not evil. That guns can save lives because guns often do save lives. As a matter of fact, guns save lives far more than they take lives. Well, Gary, thanks again for calling that in. Okay, let's go to James from Chicago.
Hey, Bob. This is James from Chicago, the gun-friendly state. Anyway, my question to you is, I was having a discussion today with a friend of mine at work, and we were discussing whether or not to leave the action/slide on semi-automatics open during storage in your gun safe. Actually, I do this, and the reason that I do it is just to keep extra movements and so forth to a minimum under a situation if I needed to get to my handgun. So basically, mag 3/4 loaded and just drop the slide. Now, I know that some people will probably debate that and say that that's not the way to do it. That's just my preference. But my question again is, what are the pros and cons of such? And I'd just like to hear your comments on it. Great show, and talk to you later.
James, I store all my guns when they're in the safe. I store them loaded, especially my handguns. They're loaded in the safe. They're ready to go. Nobody can get into the safe but me. That's it. I'm the only one that knows how to get into that safe. And what are the pros and cons? Well, I can tell you, I don't know what the pros are of leaving the action open with a magazine that's three quarters loaded. I don't know what the pro to that is. I don't know if there's any advantage to that at all. But I can tell you what I think some of the cons or some of the negatives would be. It's extra time. That's extra time. I mean, look, you know, if something happens, you've got seconds and maybe even split seconds to react. You know, you can't just take 10 seconds or whatever it takes, even an extra half a second to chamber around could cost you your life. What if it doesn't go right? What if you don't chamber around? What if you accidentally drop the magazine or something like that? Or the slide doesn't catch the round or whatever. Or maybe the magazine gets partially ejected because your adrenaline is high. You're freaked out. It's hard for you to think. All you want to do is get your gun out of the safe real quick. Pull it out and shoot this guy because he's right on top of you and about ready to kill you. I don't want anything slowing me down. And I think leaving the gun action open in the safe, that's going to slow me down. You know, it's one of the reasons I'm such a big proponent of being able to draw your pistol quickly. It's one reason I like to carry it in such a position where I can draw fast. It's a big reason I'm a big fan of appendix carry because it's a fast draw, much faster than the 3 o'clock position or the 4 o'clock position. For me, anyway. Seconds or split seconds can mean everything in a gunfight. They can mean everything. So, again, I don't really know what the pros are in keeping your guns in your safe with the action open. Now, long gun might be a little bit different. I store my shotgun without a shell chambered. All I got to do is pull it out, rack it, chamber a shell, you know, that unmistakable sound, and shoot if I need to. So I store it in the safe with the safety off, no shell in the chamber. And same with my rifles. There's a loaded magazine in the rifle, but I do have to work the action. But when it comes to a handgun I foresee something that I'm going to have to go to real quickly. And all I have to do is push the buttons on that safe. It pops open. I grab my gun. I press the trigger. And hopefully I can get rid of the situation. That's an interesting question. If some of you have an answer to James's question, or if you got your own opinion on this, feel free to call in. But that's a good question, James. I just say that I keep my handguns loaded when they're in the safe. And, of course, I keep the round chambered and the action closed. James, thanks for calling that in. Let's go to a voicemail from a listener named Terry. I think he called from Washington State.
Hey, Bob, this is Terry. I just was listening to episode, I believe it's 216. A fellow from Washington had sent you an email about a traffic situation where he drew his gun and didn't have to shoot and was wondering if he should have backed away. He mentioned one of his daughters, I believe, being in the front seat, and whether they were in the front seat or not, what came to mind with me is if he was focusing on backing up and looking behind him and the fellow drew a gun and started firing, that could have been quite a problem. So I'm not sure that I would have backed up because I would have had to draw my attention away from the potential shooter in order to face the other direction, you know, to look in the rearview mirror, to turn around, whatever the case may be. I'm also an instructor, and just a thought, you know. something to ponder. Take care, Bob. Hey, Bob, it's Terry calling right back. I just felt the need to clarify something in the voicemail and just bless you. I'm not saying that I wouldn't have backed away. I wouldn't have tried to leave the situation. I'm saying that it would have depended on whether I could have kept my focus on the possible assailant while I was doing so. Again, just a thought. Take care.
Okay, before I get to Terry's question, I wanted to clarify a couple things I said earlier in the podcast. When I was talking about training and I was responding to Damien's voicemail, what I meant to say was that many civilians have more training than some military and law enforcement. What I actually said was most civilians, and that's not really true. I don't think that most civilians have more training than military and law enforcement, but there are many of them who do. And it seems like more and more people are starting to warm up to the fact of training. Now, I don't want to harp on training because I've been accused of harping on training way too much and talking too much about it. But anyway, I wanted to correct that misspeak. The other is when I was responding to storing my handguns or when I was responding to the caller that just called in recently about storing handguns in the safe, the handguns that I have strategically placed in a safe that I'm going to possibly use, I keep loaded. Those that I'm not using, I do not keep loaded. For example, the safe that's right next to my bed, that handgun is loaded and the action is closed. Okay? The handgun that is in my office in a safe, in a handgun safe in my office at home, when I'm in my office, I keep that handgun loaded with the action closed. The other guns, when I'm not using them, they're unloaded in the safe, but the action's still closed. Okay? They're unloaded, but the action is still closed. I don't think it makes too much of a difference, unless there's some guns out there that have to be stored with the action open. I really don't think it makes too much of a difference whether they're open or closed. Now, with regard to shotguns, I have heard that a pump shotgun, that some people store those with the action open. And again, I'm not real technical, so maybe somebody can shed some light on that. That's what I've heard. I've heard that pump shotguns should be kept in the safe with the action open. Do you know anything about that? I think it has something to do with the firing pin spring or something like that. Once again, you know, I'm not technical. My ignorance on how guns actually work sometimes shows a little bit, doesn't it? Again, I'm not a gunsmith. I'm not ex-law enforcement. I'm not ex-military. I'm just a firearms trainer on the side, and I'm just an average Joe, just a Yankee with a gun trying to make a living like all of you. So I don't really get into all this gun engineering and gunsmithing stuff, but please set me straight on that if you need to. So, okay, let's get to responding to Terry's voicemail here, but I wanted to throw that in. You know, Terry, that's a good point. There's something to be said for keeping your eyes on the threat. You don't want to take your eyes off the threat if you can help it. That's a very good point. You know, we can analyze all this stuff till the cows come home, but the main thing is you have to take in the totality of all of the circumstances. This is something I learned when I went to Mag 40. The totality of the entire circumstances, the whole situation. And none of us really know because we weren't there, but if you do find yourself in the situation where you got to use your handgun, and God forbid, I hope that day never comes, but if it does, within a split second or two, you're going to have to take in the totality of the circumstances and piece it all together and make a decision. That's a heavy burden, isn't it? It's very much a heavy burden. You know, I just took my Texas CHL instructor course. And so I am now officially a Texas concealed handgun license instructor. Matter of fact, my first CHL class is April 27th in San Antonio. So if you know somebody that wants to come train with me and get their CHL, they haven't done it yet, go to handgunworld.com and click where it says Texas CHL course, April 27th on Saturday. One thing I learned in there, they also brought up the totality of the circumstances in that course as well. So it's kind of a, it's tough to do. It really is. It's tough to piece it all together in a split second or two. But, Terry, you could be right. Maybe in John's position, and he's talking about several weeks ago, John called in about, and he gave a personal story about where he had to draw his gun, thankfully not fire it, and thankfully nobody got hurt. That's the good thing, is he didn't have to use his gun, and he didn't have to fire it, but he did draw it, and he was wondering if maybe he should have just backed up and got away from the guy approaching his car. Well, maybe so, maybe not, because Terry brings up a good point in this voicemail. Backing up his car means he probably would have had to take his eyes off of the threat. And taking your eyes off the threat could cause a bunch of other problems that you don't want. That could cause some unintended consequences that you don't want because you can't see what the bad guy is doing. Good point, Terry. Let me think about that one for a while. And thanks for calling in that voicemail. Okay, let's next go to Joe. And I think Joe was calling from East Texas.
Bob, this is Joe from Quitman, Texas again. I wanted to note something on another one of the podcasts that I was listening to about having first responders in the schools. When this issue first came out and it first came up for discussion, everybody was against having first responders have weapons in schools and said that we couldn't have police officers in the schools. Quitman, Texas is northeast Texas, and there are a lot of the school districts up there that already have police officers in the schools full time. Texarkana happens to be one. They have Texarkana ISD PD. They have a police department for the school, so they have an officer in probably every school. I've worked with some of these guys, and they're first-rate police officers. They're licensed police officers for the city, and since the school is in the city, they get to work there. Texarkana is not the only one. I've seen police officers that have offices in Kilgore, and I'm sure there's plenty of other schools. It's already happening. Everybody acts like we can't do it and we can't afford it. The district, it's part of the district budget. It's happening. It's the same thing with the state of Texas. When Arizona said that they were going to have police officers check for immigrant status because you're an illegal alien. The state police here in Texas, if they pull you up, they don't have to release you. They can turn you over to the INS. I've seen it happen in my own town. So, everybody gets all up in arms saying we can't do all of these things. They're already being done. Nobody's talking about it. So anyway, just want to give you a comment on that. Enjoying the handgun show. I'm already a big listener of the Prepper Show. So keep it up. Thank you much. Appreciate it.
You know, Joe, you bring up some pretty good points. The school district where my son goes to school, they have their own police department as well. They have the ISD PD. And you're right. You're right. School districts, most school districts can afford to have armed law enforcement protecting the school. And you know what? Here in Texas, because we're a free state, the school districts that don't have the money to do that, they're allowing teachers and school administrators to be armed. Governor Perry recently was urging school districts that cannot afford to have armed officers in the schools to arm the faculty and arm the principals. You know, it was a good idea when Bill Clinton said it, but all of a sudden now it's not a good idea because the NRA is suggesting it. Have you noticed that? Have you noticed now because this is an NRA idea, because Wayne LaPierre got on TV and floated the idea of, well, let's have armed guards in schools, because it came from the NRA, now the anti-gunners are against it. Trust me, if it would have been somebody that is quote-unquote on their side, it would have been a good idea. They're playing politics with the issue. I don't like to get into politics in this show, but that's painfully obvious, is it not? Good call, Joe. Thanks for sending in that voicemail. Okay, that's it. Keep the voicemails coming, folks. I'm going to go ahead and conclude this show. I wanted to get back to a lot of you, and I think this is probably going to be a pretty effective way for me to deal with voicemails. I love the fact that you guys are calling in. Please keep calling in. You're coming up with some great stuff, and I enjoy it. 210-646-1727. I'm probably going to dedicate a middle-of-the-week show every couple weeks to answer your voicemails. Once again, that number, 210-646-1727. If you just want to call a voicemail into me and make a comment, but you don't want it on the show, just tell me that. Some of you have done that. Some of you have called in and said, Bob, please don't play this, but I wanted to give you a comment. I will definitely respect your right and your request and your right to privacy, and I won't put it on, but I'd love to hear from you anyway. And again, if you want to email me, my email address is bob@handgunworld.com. And by the way, I do read every single email. I get so many of them now that I literally do not have enough hours in the day to answer every email that comes in. But I do read every email. I assure you of that. I do have access to the internet most of the time throughout the day, either with my laptop or my iPad or my iPhone. And even though I work a full-time job, and firearms training is not my full-time job, folks, I'm a sales guy. I'm a road warrior. I'm driving around in my 2002 old paid-for Honda running around South Texas and Louisiana making sales calls because I'm in the hotel security business. That's my full-time job. That's my bread-and-butter job. That's how I support my family. Messing around with firearms and training and the podcast and all the stuff that I do and all that, this is a hobby, and of course, it's paying for my habit, let's put it that way, okay? But I do read the emails. I do find the time to read everything that you guys send in. Don't forget about the Gun Rights Radio Network Forum. Please become a member at the Gun Rights Radio Network Forum. You can interact with me and all of the other cool podcasters. By the way, listen to some of the other podcasts out there. A podcast that used to be on the Gun Rights Radio Network, I think now moved over to another network, but the Road Gunner podcast with the Unnamed Trucker, that's a good one. The Politics and Guns podcast with Paul Lathrop, that's another good one. And I still listen to the Gun Dudes, so check them out. Phenomenal entertainment. They also have good stuff. They have good educational stuff on the Gun Dudes. Listen to them. The Pro Arms podcast, I sure wish that they'd put out more shows. I think it's been a long time. Either my feed is not working, either the feed for their show is broken, or they haven't put out a podcast in a long time. Can somebody tell me what's up? Have they quit putting out shows, or do I need to unsubscribe from the podcast and resubscribe and get the feed working again or something? I don't know. But that's a good one. I also like Alex Haddix's Practical Defense podcast. And as you heard Joe mention, check out my prepper show, Today's Survival Show. It's all about prepping, modern survivalism, no tinfoil hat kind of stuff. It's called Today's Survival Show. You can find that over at www.todayssurvival.com or just search Today's Survival Show on iTunes and you'll find it. With all that said, folks, thanks for tuning in to another middle of the week podcast. I'm Bob Main. The reason I carry a gun is because I can't carry a cop. Talk to you again on Sunday. Goodbye.